Well, brethren, we're here today at the invitation, the command of the Creator of heaven and earth. More than that, we have come into the very presence of God. Last night, when that sun went down and the moon revealed its awesome fullness and light, which we might not have been able to see fully here because we had a rain just about sundown, and then we were mostly in here by the time the moon actually got up over the mountains. I saw it a couple of nights before and was hoping it would be able to be seen last night, as gorgeous as it normally is, but our particular location doesn't allow us to see it until it's up a bit, and it was probably after we were all in here. But when all of that happens and comes together, as God said it would invariably do, it announces the 15th day of the seventh month, and a joyous occasion automatically begins. Because God, our Heavenly Father, established this feast for His people and has personally convoked a meeting of His family to share in His plan and His purpose for all of mankind. A wonderful, marvelous purpose that very few people have ever known. So as we sit here this afternoon, do you personally feel the presence of God in this place? Do you know that God is here? Or are you just part of another audience of human beings listening to another feeble human being in still another meeting? Maybe even wondering how long this one will drag on. What if a dark cloud sort of began to seep into this room? What if we suddenly had darkness began to gather in these coffered ceilings and begin to come down lower and lower to where we began to wonder, will the cloud actually come down and blind our eyes so that we can't even see where we are and where we're going? What if, instead of that, a pillar of fire suddenly appeared over here in the corner somewhere and began to dance about and create the heat and the light and probably the low roar of a fire of that type? Or maybe even more dramatic than that, tongues of fire sitting on the heads of each of us. How would we react? What would be our response to such a phenomenon? Maybe run for the exits? Fire alarms go off. Yesterday we were out here having an usher's meeting. People were coming and going, doing all kinds of work, and the fire alarm started going off. And somebody said, well, this happened already yesterday, and it was a false alarm. And then we started to go, and somebody waved down the hall and said, no, you don't need to go. And then they came on and said it was a false alarm. You can go back to your places. Probably a fire drill or some welder downstairs hitting something caused a smoke alarm to go off or something of the sort. If God's glory began to fill this room in that kind of way, as it has so many times in the past, probably wouldn't set off any smoke alarms. Probably not that kind of smoke, that kind of cloud. But it would certainly set off alarms in our heads. It certainly began to cause us to ask what's really going on, and maybe began to take a little more seriously the incredible calling into the presence of God in the Feast of Tabernacles. To an outsider, this room may appear as just another convention hall or conference center. To some degree, that's what the personnel here think of it as. It has no trappings of a church or a temple, a tabernacle. Certainly it does not appear holy. There's not even a high arched ceiling. No altar, no religious symbols, no candles. Nothing that religious people might expect in this room. Nothing in outward appearance that would indicate that you and I are here to experience one of the most profound spiritual occasions that anyone could ever imagine. Do we take it like that? Is this a profound occasion? Is this a very special meeting of a very special group of people? Not because we think we're special, but because our Creator God thinks we're special. We're here to keep a feast. And this room in which we sit this afternoon has already been transformed, as it will continue to be for the duration of this 8-day period. And why? Because the presence of God is here. Because this room, believe it or not, is already filled with God's glory. Not in the cloud, not in the fire, but in the Holy Spirit of God residing in everyone here who is converted and made that commitment to God and who is a chosen child of God. God's glory is here. Because we're not here just to hold a convention, but to worship and fellowship in the very presence of the Creator of the universe. And to be taught of Him. Taught so that we might learn, so that we might in turn teach others who can learn of the wonderful ways of God. Not math or science or spelling or any of the necessary basics of physical life as man looks at them, but the very spiritual meaning and purpose of human life. The potential of every human being on earth, now and through all time, to become members or a member of the everlasting spiritual family of God. That's why we're here. So I've chosen to title this sermon, Mr. Mack said. I'm sort of like he is, I guess. I don't normally think in terms of titles, but for the record, the title of this sermon you can call Into the Presence of God. Let's take a moment to think about who our God is. Go back to the beginning in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. You probably don't need to turn there, but you're welcome to. Genesis chapter 1, I'm going to read just a handful of verses in this chapter. Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth became without form and void, tohu and bohu, empty and waste and chaotic. And darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. So one of the very first things we're told in God's Word is that God created everything, but then something happened to it, and then God began to move, and when He moved, it says the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. The power and the glory, the mind, the creative talent of God was brought to bear to restore what had been made waste and empty. And God's power and God's glory was once again revealed on the earth and began to be revealed in what God created and how He did it. In verse 26 of the same chapter, verse 26, skipping over all of the rest of the physical creation, we come to the ultimate creation of God in that 6-day period, verse 26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." God made man in His image, and God gave man dominion, rulership, authority over all that He made. And yet man, like Satan the devil, of course, misused that authority and that power, and we have some of the results that Mr. McCullough described last night in our world today. And we'll talk more about those results, no doubt, throughout this festival, as well as the solutions to man's problems and troubles, which God also, thankfully, reveals to us. Verse 27, "So God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them." Chapter 2, verse 7, just to conclude that thought, It says in the past tense, verse 7, "And the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Man became a living being, made in the very image of God. The God who called us to this beast, brethren, is the creator of all things, including life itself. In him is life, and life inherent. And he's prepared to impart that life to us and to all who will ultimately come under his authority and submit to his wonderful, perfect way of life. That's what God is doing. And it's why we're here, to take a look at what God is doing, how he's doing it, and how that marvelous plan unfolds to ultimately incorporate all humanity in the process that God has begun in this day and age in us. Begun long ago, yes, but continued today in us. In Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, as God began to utter the Ten Commandments to Israel. We read down in verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall not do any work, nor not you, your son, your daughter, your maidservant, your manservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger that is within your gates. Then notice, because in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. As God was bringing Israel out of Egypt, he had once again to reveal himself as the creator of all, the creator of the vast universe, and the God, as he said in verse 1, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. God is our creator, and God has also brought us out of the land of Egypt, but not because he just wants to save a handful of people out of today's world, but because he has a great plan unfolding, and we're a part, an integral part, a very critical, important part to God in that plan. God is using you and me. And God brings us here to draw closer to him, to learn more of his way, to be filled with his Spirit, to be filled with his glory, in order that we can go out and do that work of preparing the way for the return of Jesus Christ, of perfecting the body of Christ for the marriage supper of the Lamb, and of proclaiming the truth to all nations once that change comes that we heard about last night. So in order to keep Israel mindful of who he is and their dependence upon him and his power and his glory, God not only told them who he was and gave them his commandments, but he instructed Moses to raise up an elaborate tent in the wilderness. I was very pleased today that Mr. Horner mentioned the tabernacle and some of the trappings of it. I wanted to go through a whole lot of it, but I don't have time to do that. And then the choir, under Mr. Fox's direction, sang that hymn about the temple of God and dwelling with God, because that's really what we're going to talk about for the rest of this sermon today. The glory of God and its presence among us here, and why this feast is critical for God's people. And for those of you who are only here for the weekend, I'm sorry, but you can't keep the Feast of Tabernacles that way. We're happy to have you. We'd love to have you for all 8 days. Some few may be here under circumstances where that's all they can do. We have critical emergency medical situations that have even kept some people from arriving at the feast. And God's made provision for those things, just as he did in the Passover, in terms of being in a long journey and then being able to take the second Passover. God recognizes that it's not always possible physically for us to do exactly what we would like to do. But in heart and mind and spirit and commitment, we need to understand that this is the feast of the Eternal. This is God's feast. God set it up. God created the formula. God laid out the plan and the pattern. And God said the Feast of Tabernacles is 7 days. And then there's a last great day. So I hope that all of us who really want to serve and obey God understand that command and understand the incredible significance of it, and will not take this feast lightly at any time or in any way during this 8-day period. Exodus 24, after God had laid out the law for Israel, Exodus 24. I'm just going to skim through some of these. I'd love to read whole chapters, but that's not possible. Exodus 24, let's read verse 15 here. Moses went up into the mount, and a cloud covered the mount. This is a review of God giving Moses the commandments. And the glory of the Eternal abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and the sight of the glory of the Eternal was like devouring fire on the top of the mount in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount, and Moses was in the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now you remember the story. Moses came down from the mountain, his face glowed, it shone so brightly that the children of Israel didn't want to look upon it. And in fact, Moses later had to put a veil over his face when he was talking to the children of Israel because they couldn't stand it, because the glory of God had filled him. Because God's glory was present among the nation of Israel in a form and a physical representation that you and I don't see today. Moses was being empowered by God and shown by God what his responsibilities and job were so that he could go and proclaim God's truth to the nation of Israel on the physical level of the law of God and how they could become a great nation. But God revealed himself in a sense by not revealing himself. He revealed himself by covering himself in the cloud and in the fire. And we see that continue. I'm not going to turn to all of these scriptures, but in Exodus 25, he said to Moses, "Build me a sanctuary according to the pattern that I showed to you in the mountain." And you find that the tabernacle is all laid out in very minute detail because God has given Moses very clear instructions on how the tabernacle is to be built. And then God inspires the artisans. God inspires the workmen, the artists, the seamstresses, everybody, the engineers, if you will, to create this portable tabernacle that can be raised up, folded up, walked away with, put up again in a new place. God said, "Build me a sanctuary." Moses and the children of Israel did that, as we heard in the offertory. And then the tabernacle was reared up according to the pattern that God had given. Exodus chapter 29. Skimming through here, Exodus chapter 29. Verse 43, after describing once again the tabernacle and some of the sacrifices that go with it, God says in verse 43 of Exodus 29, "And there I will meet..." We read right over that, don't we? "There I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory." The building was sanctified by the glory of God. The building of itself wasn't holy, even though God had given the pattern the instructions of how to build it. The building was sanctified once the presence of God came into it. It was glorified. It became God's dwelling place for a temporary period of time. And God said, "I will meet you there. I will meet there with the children of Israel." Verse 44, "And I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. I will sanctify also both Aaron and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office. And I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God." Begin to comprehend that. God, the creator of the universe, is saying to Israel, "I'm going to come and dwell in this tent. I'm going to come and dwell in this physical collection of goat skins and badger skins and various kinds of purple and scarlet and various kinds of color and fabric and thread, boards. I'm going to dwell in this in the midst of you." And it was for that purpose that the tabernacle was raised up, as a temporary place for God to dwell among the Israelites, as they themselves dwelt in booths and moved from place to place on their journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. Exodus chapter 40. Exodus 40, let's begin in verse 33. And once again, we pick it up as sort of a summary situation. Exodus 40, verse 33. And he, that is Moses, he reared up the court round about the tabernacle and the altar and set up the hangings of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. Wow. Moses wasn't even able to continue going in and out of the place because the glory of God was present. Not only was it probably dark enough in the cloud, but no doubt it was a bit scary for Moses as well. Just as we've already talked about how it would be for us. Verse 36, and when the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onward in all their journeys. But if the cloud were not taken up, then they journeyed not till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Eternal was upon the tabernacle by day, and fire was on it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. Try to make yourself think about this. Imagine this. Picture this. Wash this around in your brain a little bit. And think about how it must have been to be camped out, millions of people camped out across a scattered desert sort of landscape by their tribes in a particular order that God had laid out. And have this cloud hovering over the tabernacle in the midst of the congregation. And you might be there, it says in other places, Numbers, I think, 14, is it, or Numbers 9, maybe. It talks about how, again, when the cloud went up, they moved, and when it didn't, they didn't. And it says sometimes it was for days, sometimes it was for months, and sometimes it was for years. And so the children of Israel would have to go about their business and their routines, knowing that at any moment, the cloud might start to pick up and move. And when the cloud started to pick up and move, it was time to pack your bags and hit the road, Jack. Time is important. And responsiveness to God was important. If you didn't go where the cloud went, you didn't go with the children of Israel, and you were cut off from your people. You were cut off from God. Because God dwelt in the midst of the children of Israel in the tabernacle. And where the cloud went, the tabernacle went. And where the tabernacle went, God's presence went. And where God's presence went, the children of Israel hopefully wanted to go. God's glory filled the tabernacle, and God's glory was present with Israel. Now understand, this Feast of Tabernacles, plural, tabernacles, the Feast of Booths, as we sometimes call it, God calls it, is not the Feast of the Tabernacle. I'm not talking to you about this today because this is the feast of the tabernacle raised up in the wilderness. Because this feast is about Israel's temporary dwellings while they moved from place to place. But let us not forget that God Himself was also living in a temporary dwelling. And that God, in the person of Jesus Christ, the Eternal, was willing to temporarily dwell in a tabernacle until the true spiritual temple could be built. No, not Solomon's temple. Not the second temple, but the true temple of God. Until that time, God dwells in temporary tabernacles. Understand today that God has moved His dwelling place more than once. And God has moved His dwelling place today into another, more spiritual location. A more spiritual building, that is to say, as Paul says, a building not made with hands. God has moved His glory and His presence into His church. His church. the present-day temple of the Holy Spirit. And yet the church itself must yet be transformed into spirit. The church itself must yet be changed to be like God. Again, as we heard last night, we will see Him as He is. And then at that time, God will begin to call all peoples, every miserable creature that has drawn breath from this earth that is a human being, who has not already rejected God, and that evidently would not be very many, will have the opportunity to choose between life and death, partly because God is presently dwelling in a temporary tabernacle that is made up of guess whom? You and me. Made up of you and me in this church today. God will begin to call all people into His true temple, His spiritual temple, to worship Him. Let's fast forward a moment from Moses to 1 Kings chapter 7. 1 Kings chapter 7. Mr. McCullough was talking about all the changes taking place last night and the last 100 years or so, and you think about the term fast forward. Covered wagon people wouldn't have followed that very well. Fast forward was 3 miles a day or something. What was it? A good day, maybe 7 or 10. 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 51. Pick it up right at the close here and then on into chapter 8. Verse 51 of chapter 7. Solomon has been building a temple for God. David had put a lot of the materials together. God hadn't let David build it. God had told Solomon he could build it and gave him very specific instructions. And if you read through them all, they're remarkably like the tabernacle. Verse 51, so was ended all the work that King Solomon made for the house of the Eternal. And it's good to go back and read this fairly regularly and read about the workmanship and read about the quality and read about the gold and read about the incredible value, the incredible worth of God's house that was still a physical, temporary house. And Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold and the vessels did he put among the treasures of the house of the Eternal. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the ark of the covenant of the Eternal out of the city of David, which is Zion. Drop down to let's read a little bit farther here. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the 7th month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. And they brought up the ark of the Eternal, and the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, even those did the priests and the Levites bring up. And the King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. And the priests brought in the ark of the covenant of the Eternal unto its place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim, where the mercy seat, the very throne of God, was represented. For the cherubim spread forth their two wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim covered the ark and the staves thereof above. And they drew out the staves, at the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without. And there they are to this day, he said at that time. There was nothing in the ark except the two tables of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb when the Eternal made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. So now we're harking all the way back to the first tabernacle. And the ark is put into the temple. Verse 10. And it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Eternal, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, because the glory of the Eternal had filled the house of the Eternal. Sound familiar? Sound like what happened when Moses couldn't go back into the tabernacle because the cloud and the glory of God had filled the house? Of course it does. Because God is again dwelling among Israel, this time in a stable physical temple that is built on foundations and isn't movable, but it's still temporary. Still very, very temporary. In fact, let's go to chapter 9 and notice the warning that we might well pay some heed to. warning in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 1. Remember, God's glory filled this house. And it becomes a very dramatic picture. Chapter 9, verse 1. And it came to pass when Solomon had finished the building of the house of the Eternal and the king's house and all Solomon's desire, which he was pleased to do, that the Eternal appeared to Solomon the second time, as it appeared to him in Gibeon. And the Eternal said unto him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication. The dedication of the temple and Solomon's prayer that God would be present in it. I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have hallowed this house which you have built to put my name there forever. Notice the house wasn't holy to begin with. He hallowed it. He made it holy. Only God can do that. And he said, I made it holy to put my name there. Forever. Forever, notice. It was possible for it to be there forever. And my eyes and my heart shall be there perpetually. And if you will walk, if you will walk before me as David your father walked in integrity of heart and in uprightness to do according to all that I have commanded you and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish your throne. And so he offers Solomon to become a permanent dynasty if he will obey him. Verse 6, but if you shall at all turn from following me, you or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I have given them, and this house, which I have hallowed for my name, will I cast out of my sight. He just said, I will put my name there and it can reside there forever. But if you turn away, if you reject me, if you reject my truth and my purpose and my laws, and you go and worship other gods and decide to reason around it as human beings do and do your own thing, well, forget it. My presence isn't always going to be in this house. This is a temporary place. And I will cast them out, and this house which I have hallowed for my name, I will cast out of my sight. We would do well to remember that lesson in the light of recent history of the people of God. And Israel shall be a proverb and a byword among all people. And at this house, this glorious, wonderful temple had to be one of the most magnificent, if not absolutely the pinnacle of anything ever built on the earth. And he said, this house, which is high, everyone that passes by it shall be astonished and shall hiss, and they shall say, why has the Eternal done this unto this land and to this house? Why is God not present in this beautiful temple? And they shall answer, because they forsook the Eternal their God, who brought forth their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and have taken hold upon other gods and have worshipped them and served them. Therefore has the Eternal brought upon them all this evil. Brethren, the name Church of God doesn't mean anything outside of the total picture of God's relationship with His people. The physical name, the words, the letters, the titles, they don't mean anything. The words Feast of Tabernacles don't mean anything. Unless we're here to keep the feast according to God's prescription and God's designed plan. God must be in it. Ironically, I have to point this out at this time. Maybe it would be some encouragement to my older friend, Mr. McCullough, down here. I remember many sayings from my years in college in the mid-60s in Big Sandy when he was the deputy chancellor. One of the things I remember then, I remember in working with him in several different relationships down through decades now, one thing Mr. McCullough always said was, if God isn't in it, I don't want any part of it. And I carried that quote around with me all these years. It's an obvious truth, but just the way he would say it. If God isn't in it, you know, there'd be some kind of political arguments going on, some kind of big doctrinal brouhaha, whatever going on in the church. And Mr. Mack would say, if God isn't in it, I don't want any part of it. If God isn't in it, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what we call ourselves. Doesn't matter what days we keep. Doesn't matter what we name the church. God named the church, and we've accepted that name, yes. But the name is not enough. The temple was not enough. God said, I will cast it out. People will hiss and say, what happened? That's happened in this modern era of the church as well, hasn't it? Could it happen again? Of course. Now, we don't want to dwell on those things during this feast, as he said last night. We don't want to dwell on those things during this feast, but we do want to be reminded, don't we, that while we're sitting here absorbing, and I say that thoughtfully, absorbing the glory of God from here and through His Spirit, we need to remember that it can happen again. We need to remember that it's only our relationship with God and our closeness to God and our obedience to God's commands that makes it possible for us to be the people of God. It's God in us. It's God with us. It's God dwelling among us that makes us His people. That's a considerable warning, I would say, that Solomon received that came to pass. Came to pass so that temple was destroyed and another temple had to be built. Let's fast forward again to Haggai. Haggai chapter 1. In Haggai chapter 1, we're looking at the time period when Israel was coming back out of captivity in Babylon. And Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah, ultimately Zerubbabel, had been dispatched to begin to restore God's nation. And in Haggai chapter 1, we read this admonition. Chapter 1, verse 7. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways. Look at the context. Consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, says the Eternal. God says, go ahead, build me a house. I will take pleasure in your dedication and your commitment to build me a house. And I will be glorified. Interesting how glory works. God pours out His glory, but what we do in response glorifies God. Interesting terminology. But of course, they began to build the house, and the house compared to Solomon's temple just wasn't much to look at. They didn't have the resources. They didn't have the silver and the gold. They didn't have all the power of David and Solomon. They were a struggling little handful of people coming out of captivity trying to reestablish their identity as the people of God. And notice what happens in chapter 2, verse 1. In the seventh month, in the 21st day of the month, you recognize that, don't you? Seventh month, the 21st day of the month, came the word of the Eternal by the prophet Haggai, saying, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? He doesn't answer that question, but I have to say it wouldn't have been very many people after 70 years, would it? Who among you saw this house in its first glory? Maybe there were some elderly people, because the way he says it indicates maybe there were some people to testify and to witness to the difference and the comparison between the former house and the latter house. Who's left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes, in comparison of it, as nothing? This temple isn't worth talking about compared to Solomon's temple, he says. Yet now, be strong, O Zerubbabel, says the Eternal, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all you people of the land, says the Eternal, and work, for I am with you, says the Eternal of Hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Fear you not. I'm still here, God says. Sure, I dwelt in the temporary tabernacle, and it's gone. I dwelt in a beautiful temple, and it's gone. But I'm still here. And you're building another temple, and guess what? The physical accoutrements are not what counts. Going on, verse 6, for thus says the Eternal of Hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens. I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. That's Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the King of kings and Lord of lords. And I will fill this house, with glory, says the Eternal of Hosts. The silver is mine and the gold is mine. Don't worry about those things. I don't need silver and gold, says the Eternal of Hosts. The latter house shall be greater than that of the former, says the Eternal of Hosts, and in this place will I give peace, says the Eternal of Hosts. This is a dual prophecy in that sense of God's blessing upon the nation for responding to him obediently, but a looking forward to of the time when Jesus Christ would return in person and fill the house with glory. Greater than the first house. It isn't the physical circumstances. We sit here today in a rented hotel ballroom. A very fine hotel ballroom, as hotel ballrooms go. Can it be filled with glory? Is it filled with glory? Is God here? Did God place his name here? And let's understand that. God didn't say, I'm going to have the feast in Steamboat Springs. Now let's see if Larry Neff and Richard Pennelly and all these people can figure that out. God let us choose the site, and then God put his name here. Just as the houses were built, and then God glorified them. But God is here. God's name is here. God's presence is here. And you and I have come into the very presence of God to worship and serve him during this Feast of Tabernacles, so that we can learn from him. And we can become instruments in his hands to do what he is still working at accomplishing. Because God has dwelt in temporary houses from the time man has existed in one sense, certainly from the time the tabernacle was raised up. And God is today dwelling temporarily in our physical flesh, which is going to die. But guess what? God has not finished building his dream house. God has a dream house. It's a spiritual temple. It's a perfect spiritual temple. It's a temple that will be permanent, that will last and last and last. So where is the cloud and the fire today? Or where are the cloud and the fire today? Mr. Hart was up here testing the sound yesterday. He was saying, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. And so forth. And he says, where are the peck of pickled peppers Peter Piper picked? And I was standing there. I said, where is the peck of pickled peppers Peter Piper picked? He looked at me. I think maybe they said it differently in Canada, you know. So I walked off, and I was back near the back. And my son and I were walking back through. Then we hear Mr. Hart up here. And he's saying, Peter Piper picked Peter Piper picked two pecks of pickled peppers. Cracked us up. Where is the cloud today? Where is the fire today? Where is God's glory? Where is God's presence? And where is God being revealed? Let's go quickly now through a few scriptures in the time we have. Exodus chapter 33. Moses asked that question. Moses wanted to know what God's glory really was. Moses had seen the cloud and the fire. We read that. But here in Exodus chapter 33, verse 18, if I can get my Bible open there. Exodus 33, verse 18. And he, that is Moses, said, I beseech you, show me your glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Eternal before you, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy to whom I will show mercy. That was his response to Moses saying, show me your glory. And so we come on over to chapter 34, verse 5. And the Eternal descended. Now this is when God said, I'll put my hand over you and you can see my back parts, but you can't see my face because you can't live. So the Eternal descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Eternal. Here's God proclaiming his name and his glory in response to Moses' question, show me your glory. What does he reveal himself to be? The Eternal passed by before him and proclaimed, the Eternal, yes, the ever-living Eternal God, the Eternal God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but that will by no means clear the guilty. This is God. This is God who's perfect in character and has a perfect plan and who wants us to come into harmony with it. Verse 9. And he said, "Now, if now I have found grace in your sight, O Eternal, let my Lord, I pray you, go among us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance." Moses saw God's glory, and what was it? It was goodness. It was mercy. It was dependability. It was perfect character. It was righteousness. The very glory of God is his character. It's his name. It's his power. It's his perfection. And that glory of God was revealed to Israel, physical, carnal Israel, in dramatic physical terms of cloud and fire. Today, it's revealed to you and me in the power of God's Spirit working in feeble, puny human beings to change our minds and hearts to be his people. The glory of God is here, brethren. Don't you ever doubt it. And don't ever sell it short. The glory of God is his character, and he's given it to us. Fast forward again to the New Testament church, 2 Corinthians chapter 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 7 and 8. Again, it helps to read this whole context. We don't have time for that. But if the ministration of death, written and engraven in stones, so this is God's law and God's system of judgment for Israel as well as the rest of mankind, actually. And Paul says it was glorious. Notice, if the ministration of death, written and engraved in stones, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance, which glory was to be done away, how shall not the ministration of the Spirit be rather glorious? You and I live in the spirit of the law. It's a glorious process that God has designed. How shall it not be glorious? Verse 9, for if the ministration of condemnation be glory, much more does the ministration of righteousness exceed in glory. For even that which was made glorious had no glory in this respect by reason of the glory that excels. A comparison, he says, wouldn't be glorious at all. The glory that was in the old system has no glory when compared to the new. It's the reverse of the temples. So, for that, if that which is done away, verse 11, was glorious, much more that which remains is glorious. The work that God is doing in human beings today in conversion is a glorious work. And you and I are here to look forward to the time when that glorious work will be extended to the entire world. Billions of forsaken people. What God is doing is dwelling in us. Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9, if you read the Apostle Paul's writings, because of his history as an Israelite of the Israelites, as he says, you begin to pick up the comparisons and the nuances of what God has continuously done and how it was revealed in different ways at different times. Chapter 9, verse 6. Now when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone once every year, not without blood, the Day of Atonement, of course, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. The Holy Spirit thus signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing. It wasn't time yet for the spiritual temple to be built. Verse 11, skipping down. But Christ, having become a high priest of good things to come, by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building. Christ is carrying out a work as a high priest in a spiritual temple, and that temple today is being built in the church. And when you and I come into this ballroom, the Spirit of God comes here, and the converted minds come here, God's glory is here. And God is dwelling right here among us as we keep this Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 22, and almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without shedding of blood is no remission. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens, spiritual things, should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ is not entered into the holy place made with hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself now to appear in the presence of God for us, our spiritual high priest. Verse 28, so Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. Not just us who look for him really, but salvation for all of mankind. Christ is now dwelling among us. How much glory have we? How much glory have you personally brought to this house as you've come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles? We are each an element in the building of the spiritual temple. We're part of the silver and the gold that was a representation of this spiritual character that's being built. God is constructing in the Spirit a temple not made with hands. And God's glory is declared in His law. God's glory is declared in His word. God's glory is declared in this feast, and God's glory will be proclaimed in sermons. And God's glory will be revealed and proclaimed in music and fellowship and activities. As we prefigure the conversion of the world in these days when they are fulfilled, we are here to glorify God and allow God to, in a sense, share His glory with us. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 14. We haven't gotten there yet this feast, I don't believe. Deuteronomy chapter 14. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. This is all part of God's plan and design and prescription for building the spiritual temple. Even though this was given to ancient Israel, it was prefiguring what we're doing today. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year, and you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place which He shall choose to place His name there, the tithe of your corn, of your wine, your oil, your firstlings of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn what? To fear the Eternal your God always. God has brought us here for our benefit to learn to fear God on the basis of what He's doing, not only in our lives, but in the lives of all the humanity, past, present, and future. We're here to learn to fear God and to appreciate His plan. Skipping down, let's go down to verse 26. And you shall bestow that money for whatsoever your soul desires, for oxen, for sheep, or wine, or strong drink, or for whatsoever your soul desires, and you shall eat there before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. God brought us here to keep His feast, to rejoice before Him, physically and eating and drinking and fellowship and activities, balloon rides, or, you know, skiing down hills that don't have any snow on them, and some of the things you can do around here. Oh, there's a slope over there. I think you can ski, or maybe not ski, but at least bobsled without any snow. You can find all kinds of things here to do. You can even go up in the hills and get shot at if you're so minded. I hope you're not. But God intends to keep us mindful of His mercy and of what He's doing. Ephesians chapter 2. God brought us here to keep a feast because we are His people. He dwells among us, and He is still building that spiritual temple. Ephesians chapter 2. Verse 19, Ephesians 2. Now therefore, you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. We're part of God's household, part of God's family, the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, grows unto what? An holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. God is dwelling in us through His Spirit right now. Temporary dwellings, to be sure. But a temporary dwelling that is being changed and molded and shaped into a spiritual permanent dwelling, the dwelling place of God, the true spiritual temple of God. We are God's people, and God is bringing us into His temple. Let's fast forward once again. We'll hear more about this in a sermon later in the feast. But let's fast forward to Revelation chapter 3. I'm sorry, I think I did it backwards. I went 21:3, not 3:21. Revelation 21. Transpose my own notes here. Revelation 21, verse 3. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them and shall be their God. God's work progresses. God's work moves forward. God's plan goes according to His plan, His timetable. But ultimately, God is going to build a spiritual temple of which everybody can be a part who is willing to submit and choose to be a part of that family. God is working in you and me today. God is going to dwell with mankind, as he has in temporary dwellings all these many years. But brethren, we must remember once again, while we may tell the world, sometimes teachers or friends or whatever, we're going to Steamboat Springs to go to a church convention. I said that to a neighbor, going to a church convention. Didn't have time to explain the feast days. Going to a church convention. This is not just a church convention. We're not just here by our choice, though we had to make a choice to obey God's command. We've been called into the very presence of the God who created all things, the God who gives us life and breath, the God who forgives our sins and forgets our iniquities and holds out the hope of eternal life to those whom he has called today, those who are in his church, those in whom he dwells right now. God has actually placed his name here. This is the Feast of the Eternal, the feast picturing the future calling of billions with whom God himself will dwell. We must rejoice. How can we help but rejoice? How can we restrain from rejoicing and glorifying the great God of the universe? Have a great feast.